forum will open as a subcommittee, and we'll discuss first our executive appointments. Jim?
Madam Co-Chair and members, you have eight appointees to consider, five for the Commission on the Blind, two for the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, and one for the Board of Medical Examiners. I understand that we're going to be holding over the Port of Coos Bay appointee. Let me discuss a little bit about the five Commission for the Blind. Frank Armstrong is the representative of Blind Oregonians. It's a reappointment. He is the regional president of the Blind Veterans Association area where he lives, which is out in Newport. He's a retired manager of the Newport office of the Employment Department. Volunteers at the VA hospital, where he's an editor and reporter for the iCenter newsletter. Donald Dart is also a representative of Blind Oregonians. This is a new appointment. He's a self-employed Portland attorney. In his statement of interest, he tells that when he first became blind a few years ago, the commission's mobility lessons and computer instruction were instrumental to his returning to work. Irvin Handelman is the third of the five Commission for the Blind appointees. He's a Portland ophthalmologist and has been since 1976. This is a new appointment. He fills one of three positions on the board reserved for representatives of five specific fields. The appointments rotate among those five. The five are employers, labor, optometry, ophthalmology, and education of the blind. He is the former president of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. He states a long-term interest in serving the visually impaired. Edward Ripplinger is a representative of Blind Oregonians. This is a reappointment. He has been a client of the commission since 1960 and active in the commission's business enterprise program since 1981. He is currently the manager of Rip's Cafe over in the Revenue Building here on the Capitol Mall. Elizabeth Russo Rooney is a representative of Blind Oregonians. It's a reappointment. She is a Grants Pass occupational therapist. Two appointees for the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots include Katie Iman, public member from Bandon. This is a reappointment. She lists experience as an attorney and mediator and states that a strong tie between maritime industry and economic health is one of her interests. Charles Yates is a Coos Bay Bar and Harbor pilot, has been since 1984.
You're holding that one, correct?
Yes. This, you're not holding Mr. Yates that I know of.
Oh.
Mr. Yates is on the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots.
It's the next one.
He happens to be a Coos Bay Bar and Harbor pilot, but he's not on the International Port of Coos Bay. There is one position on the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots reserved for a pilot from Coos Bay or Yaquina Bay, and I think he does both. His experience in Coos Bay dates back to 1973 as a deckhand and later as a tugmaster. He expresses interest in preventing maritime casualties, promoting safe maritime commerce, and protecting marine estuaries. The last one that I have on my list for today is the Board of Medical Examiners. This is Clifford Devaney. He is an Oregon Health and Sciences University surgeon, professor, and chief of the General Surgery Division. He's been at OHSU since 1987. This is a new appointment. He fills the Congressional District 3 position on the board. And one of the reasons your packet was so thick is with the long list of accomplishments for Dr. Devaney.
Thank you, Jim. See, we do not have a quorum yet, so we can't act on any of these. Senator Brown, would you like to make an announcement?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I'd like to welcome the young women that are here from Girls State. They're from all over the state, from Sutherland High School to Reedsport to where else? Salem. And I spoke to them last night. This is the Senate Rules Committee. It's co-chaired by Bev and I, Senator Clarno and I. Remember, we talked about her being the Republican leader. I'm the Democratic leader. And we have three Democrats and three Democrats and three Republicans on the committee. Unfortunately, we don't have a quorum, which is four out of the six. So Senator Corcoran, who's a Democrat, will be back. And you have the wonderful Senator Jason Atkinson here as well from Jacksonville. So welcome. We're going to do some executive appointments, which are confirming appointments that the governor has done to boards and commissions. And then we'll have a bill. And I don't know how long. How long can you all stay?
You're still in executive appointments.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We can do executive appointments.
So we'll do executive appointments. And then we'll move on to a bill. So Welcome and have fun.
Welcome. Nice to have you here. We will now go into...
You know, I got kicked out of Boys State, so... You could end up being a legislator. Just be careful. And I was a senator. And I was in Roswell, New Mexico.
Okay, I'll open a work session on executive appointments. Senator Brown.
Madam Chair, I would move to the floor the executive appointments set forth in today's agenda, with the exception of the Oregon International Board of Commissioners, Port of Coos Bay.
Senator Brown's moves the executive appointments to the floor with a due pass recommendation listed as we've reviewed, except for the Oregon International Board of Commissioners of Port of Coos Bay.
What happened with that?
Any objections?
No objections.
No objections?
No objections.
I can be objectionable. But.
Oh, I know that, okay. Senator. No objections. Any discussion first, please. You were under discussion. No objections, right? So moved.
And who would you like to have?
Senator Atkinson, would you like to carry this?
I would. I would like to, specifically for one of the commissioners on the Commission for the Blind. So that'd be
okay.
Great.
Is that okay to have him carry all those? All right. Thank you very much.
If he pronounces the names right, Madam Chair.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 901. Jim?
Madam Co-Chair, Senate Bill 901 is the companion measure to SJR 13. This is Senator Hannan's bill. I don't believe that Senator Hannan is going to be able to testify here, so let me explain a little bit more about it. SJR 13A is the one that proposes amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow the use of revenue currently dedicated to the construction and maintenance of public highways to also be used for policing of public highways. SJR 13A passed out of the Senate May 12th unanimously. It's currently in the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs. Senate Bill 901 is the companion because it sets the procedure for a statewide special election on SJR 13, and it sets that election to be held November 4th, 2003. This would be a special election, and it has a special appropriation included in it as a blank. I think you'll see that blank. Let me just look at the measure here briefly. You'll see that blank on page 3 in line 25. The measure declares an emergency effective upon passage. You have the dash 1 amendment, which fills in the blank with the figure $1.5 million, and that figure was derived after discussion with the Secretary of State's office to discuss the costs of a special election such as the one proposed in Senate Bill 901.
Okay, we have John from the Secretary of State's office. You want to come on up, John?
I'm John Lindbeck, Director of Elections for the Secretary of State. I just wanted to make myself available today in case any of you had questions about the $1.5 million or the timelines for such an election. The $1.5 million was approximately what it cost for the September 28th special election and for the special election that we had in January.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions of John? Thank you very much, John.
Madam Co-Chair, I should say this bill, Senate Bill 901, does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means from the President's office. $1.5 million, we're advised that that's where it should go, is to Ways and Means.
Okay, we will open anyone else here to speak on Senate Bill 901? If not, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 901. Senator Brown?
Senator Clarno, I would move the dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 901.
Senator Brown moves the dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 901. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
Senator Clarno, I would move Senate Bill 901 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Brown has moved Senate Bill 901 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
With a due pass.
With a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so moved.
Blazing speed. Well,
now, if we can't do 139, we'll either...
Well, as long as you wait on it, Stephanie, we get started on 139.
139.
We'll go ahead with 3010 and let's stand. Let's have a recess for a second.
We need some amendments.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 139, and we'll have Jim talk to us about that bill. Then we'll see if there's anyone. We have no one on the sign-up sheet, and I'm assuming there's somebody that will want to testify on that. So.
Madam Co-Chair, when I made my presentation last week, I was discussing the dash twos, which were the amendments that we put together based on the meeting and the ideas that we've had early on this. Since that time, we also generated the dash three amendments. The dash three amendments are identical to dash twos, except for the fact that they remove the special account in the Secretary of State's office for the voters' pamphlet. In the original bill, it calls for an elections account. The amendments, the dash twos, call for a voters' pamphlet account. The dash threes, that account is out completely. The other set of amendments, I understand, is a dash four that other interested parties have put together. I have not seen the dash four. I left space for that on your summary, so you can put some notes in there if you wish. That's where we are, a number of alternatives for considering for Senate Bill 139.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Anyone who want to come up and testify, please come forward now on 139. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
There's a tough-looking panel up here, next chair.
You better behave.
I'm going to put on a Kevlar vest.
Chair Quarno, members of the committee, I'm Andy Miller, Executive Director for Oregon Common Cause. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about the Dash 4s. I was the interested party, and I have worked with a number of people on these Dash 4s, and there aren't a lot of must-haves, but the most important, there were two things that I really asked Senator Corcoran for. One was to retain the voter pamphlet account. I think that's very, very important. This is such a critical piece of our democracy. Everyone loves the voter's pamphlet. If you ask, and many focus groups have, it's extremely important to the Oregon citizen. We are all looking for ways to keep things alive through funding mechanisms that make sense. To me, the voter's pamphlet account makes sense. In the original 139, there was an elections account, I believe, was the title. And we like it this way, more specifically, to preserve this piece. One of the concerns we had, so that's the largest thing in the Dash 4s. That is back in. One of the biggest concerns I had personally and my executive committee had was the cost to people that are putting measures on the ballot. Our group represents a lot of grassroots efforts. And those efforts are truly from people and do not have large treasuries. These charges, I understand that we have a difficult time and we want to have a pamphlet, but these charges are very high. And not only that, there's a huge difference between the small ad and the large ad, as I call them, because, in fact, we are talking about ads. So our suggestion was that we sunset these prices and reevaluate them after two election cycles, which would be at the end of 2006 cycle, so that we may see where we are in terms of democracy and in terms of the budget, and look at these rates again and see if we can't make them more equitable for the people that are doing the grassroots initiatives. The whole idea of the size of the ad, I had a concept that did not make it into these amendments, which I called ad equity, which is reducing the disparity between the largest and the smallest ads. So hopefully, as you go through all the sets of amendments you have, you'll look at a way to look at that concept and find ways. I could not get agreement from all the various parties that I talked to on what was ad equity. So I hope that that issue is discussed when you have a work session on this. The other thing is we did not change the part where the ballot text was taken out of the bill. It will be out of the voter pamphlet. To our organization, that was unfortunate but not critical because there were other ways to find that text. But on speaking with other folks, there were focus groups that were done, and a lot of people feel it's very necessary for the credibility of the ballot to have that text in there. So we're flexible either way on that. So that's kind of what we're asking for with these particular amendments.
And you don't have a copy of those, is that correct? We don't have.
You don't. Senator Corcoran's, Chair Carano, I believe that Senator Corcoran's office had a stack of them. I got mine.
Gulp. Okay, let's go on to the next testimony while he's looking for those.
Good afternoon, Senator Carano, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We very much appreciate your having a hearing on Senate Bill 139. As a grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages people to participate and to vote, we strongly support the continuation of the voters' pamphlet in however you can do that. But I will address the Dash 4 amendment. Particularly today. We took part in the work group discussion on 139, which resulted in the Dash 1 and 2 amendments, which Mr. Stembridge has presented to you. We also participated in drafting the Dash 4 amendments, and I'll address my comments primarily to those and briefly to the Dash 3 proposal. The League supports the following amendments to 139. First, the establishment of a voter's pamphlet reserve account, which is removed in the Dash 3 amendments. We believe that this is sustained by the receipt of fines and fees and other revenues through election activities, and it can be used to fund the voter's pamphlet publication and distribution. So we believe that reserve count is particularly important. Secondly, while the League believes that the text of measures is very important to have in the voter's pamphlet, we would compromise and agree to, in the interests of a smaller voter's pamphlet, to remove that text with a sunset for two election cycles. So after the 2006, we would like to discuss putting back the text measure. And we do support the increase in fees for candidates and measure arguments with the space reductions as necessary, and that also with a 2000 sunset provision. Echoing what Andy Miller has said, the realistic part is that in order to fund the voter's pamphlet, we need to have an increase in fees. But this proposes a difficulty for people. So reluctantly, but realistically, we support the increase in fees, which means that measure arguments would go up significantly. There is still a $500 option for a very small piece in the voter's pamphlet, so at least that piece is there, but the others go up proportionately. But as long as there is a sunset provision, we can go along with that. It's our understanding that if you go with the total increase that's proposed in the original 139, you can about cover the cost of producing and distributing the voter's pamphlet. But realistically, as I said, that's too much. So if you reduce space by having arguments that are smaller space, by putting candidates perhaps either three or four to a page, in other words, shrinking the size of the pamphlet, then you probably, in removing the text, it would appear that the data supporting the costs and the distribution could be covered But we also feel that you do need a small amount of general fund money. That's one of the sticking points. But we urge the committee to take a look at that, because the production and distribution to the voters of the voters' pamphlet is an extremely good public policy, and it's important for our elections process. So we urge you to strongly consider these -4 amendments, but also whatever, in whatever way possible you can, to continue the voters' pamphlet. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Please go ahead, and then we'll have a time for questions.
I'm Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project. Obviously, the voters' pamphlet is a very important tradition in Oregon politics, and so obviously, you know, it's sometimes can be helpful when something like the budget crunch points out possible efficiencies, suitable fee adjustments. As an organization, we are concerned, though, because of the value as an education, election education resource, that there not necessarily be, you know, a wholesale shift to thinking that the voters' pamphlet should be a self-sustaining entity, and just really keep in mind that it's a very appropriate use of general fund dollars. The credibility of the voters' pamphlet really comes from completeness and fairness. Allowing the same size statement to each candidate and to any entity interested in commenting on ballot measures. So it seems like too much tweaking with size options and cutting content, you know, undermines this credibility. So that's a big concern. If indeed, you know, there are some changes along those lines, it seems like it's important to sunset them. I particularly want to zero in on some of the suggestions. My focus is on the -2 version related to the ballot measure statements. An organization already can buy more than one ballot measure statement. So there's already kind of a situation in the current voters' pamphlet where more money can buy more speech. But it does seem like this trend's aggravated by the proposal to allow, you know, this significant, like it's 5 or 6 different size options. And it seems really telling that under this proposal, candidates retain the one size standard, and it seems like you want to err a little bit more on that side, end of the spectrum, with regards to the ballot measure statements too, or you start to kind of have this piecemeal looking document. So that may mean, you know, if you take a look at the candidate statement changes with regards to the primary, the ballot measure statements could roughly be cut in about half, with an increase in cost of about 3 times. You know, if they're, I think it makes sense to potentially have a low cost option, but I think that in general, you know, no more than 2 size options for ballot measures, and that the size disparity between those options be relatively narrow, so you don't have like a situation where, because they will not be grouped by size, they're grouped by the order in which they come in, and so depending on how all that plays out, you know, you could have a bunch of little ones. Anyway, it just could be a little bit of a problem. But in general, just it's obviously a resource in order we need to keep going, and even if it does mean some use of general funds, that seems appropriate. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Brown.
Yes. Where'd Kathy go? Oh,
she had to go and drink some water.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kathy. I was, like, reading. I wanted to pick on you because I feel like in terms of being involved in the political process the most, your role is probably the more directly related of the three of you that are here. And last week I went to my good buddies, the Multnomah County Democrats meeting, and my good buddy Vern Cook had a resolution opposing any fee increase in the voters' pamphlet. And while I didn't think it was particularly realistic, I was probably one of a handful of no votes on the resolution. But the concern there clearly is that the fees listed will really be a hampering factor for folks running for school boards and those kinds of things. I don't see it as a huge barrier for legislative races. I think the caucuses, frankly, probably do too good a job fundraising and helping out their candidates. But I'm more concerned about folks who are really doing this on a volunteer basis, and would kind of like to get your response on that one.
I'm not sure. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Allergies. Senator Clarno, Senator Brown, I think a number of these smaller groups probably do not appear in the state voters pamphlet. The school boards, for instance, those kinds of things. Thank you. The fees for the appearing in a county or city voters pamphlet have not been increased.
Okay.
And that is a problem I think it's Bill 2747.
That was the other bill we did. Okay. All right. Okay. So you feel pretty comfortable that most statewide candidates can reach the fees that we set forth in here?
Senator Brown, as I said, we're uncomfortable with the fact that they would have to be increased. But realistically, if we're going to keep a voter's pamphlet and not totally cover it by general fund, then I think that's the only way we have to go.
Thank you. I'm kidding. Sorry, I forgot. David Gamble. And thanks for the suggestions. I think we'll be taking a look at the numbers, and we've just been handed the Dash 4 amendment. So, any other questions?
Senator Brown, this all became a problem when there was a tremendous cut of $1.3 million in the Elections Division budget as a result of Measure 28's failure. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So I think we're all trying to look at how can we take care of this, aside from trying to charge voters for receiving the voter's pamphlet. I don't hear anybody bringing that as a reasonable suggestion, but I think to deny that is a very bad public policy.
Okay, thank you, and we really appreciate you coming back.
No problem.
New performance.
Madam Co-Chair, if I could just mention that we try to make copies of the Dash 4. If there's anyone who did not get a copy of the Dash 4, would like it, please come by the committee office, and we will get you a copy of the Dash 4 amendment.
Do we have any other folks signed up?
We do not.
Okay. All right. Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 139? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139. And unfortunately, the committee will be at ease until Senator Clarno returns, which we anticipate will be shortly. So, right? Touch that one. Mr. Sembridge, could you walk us through the amendments? We have both the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s.
What are you doing?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 3010 requires the Director of Department of Consumer Business Services to adopt rules conforming to federal regulations relating to the direction of steel. You have the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. The Dash 1s come from or OSHA. They replace the bill. It prohibits the Director of DCBS from requiring fall protection for steel erectors on that required in federal regulation, adds a sunset date of December 31st, 2007. The Dash 2s come from AGC. It adds a liability exemption for employers when workers suffer death or injury from falls greater than 10 feet, notwithstanding the adopted fall protection standard. So the Dash 1, the Dash 2, I know of no other amendments to the bill.
It was probably all in my head then. Dash 1 amendments are the consensus amendments by those wishing to move the bill forward. Is that correct with OROSHA?
That's what I understand.
Okay.
I think OROSHA's involvement was to, I don't know if they necessarily agree with it, but it made it so that they could administer the...
Okay.
the measure.
Do I have a motion on the dash one amendments?
Are we in work session?
We're in work session. Senator Corcoran.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the dash one amendments to 3010.
Senator Corcoran has moved the dash one amendments to 3010. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay. Dash two amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3010.
Senator Beyer moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3010. Any discussion? Any objection?
Could Senator Beyer sort of walk us through the dash two amendments and let us know whether these are consensus amendments or not?
Madam Chair and Co-Chair, the dash two amendments seek, and the co-chair could probably, as being an attorney, could probably speak more directly to what they do. But they, my understanding of the dash twos is that if an employer provides fall protection for employees at, for levels of higher, greater than 10 feet above a platform, and the employee decides not to use it, and some conforming with statute now or with the CENRAC rules up to 30 feet, but if the employee falls from the structure, the employee would not be able to sue the employer for Employer Liability Act lawsuits and still have workers' comp benefits and all that, everything there, but would not be subject to the employer, would not be subject to Employee Liability Act lawsuit. That is my understanding of the amendment. Is that what you would also say, Madam Co-Chair?
She's co-chairing now.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Any other questions of Senator Beyer?
I have no questions of Senator Beyer, Madam Chair, but I'll be a no on the amendment.
Okay.
I would just like to say the amendments are a little bit inconsistent in that the dash ones change the paragraph, and so do the dash two. The dash two stay with the original language on the specific paragraph, and this is you'll see on page two of the dash ones, lines 23 through 26 are not the same as lines 23 through 24 on page two of the dash two amendment. I believe that the float this as a trial balloon here. I believe that the section that Senator Beyer is particularly interested in is section 2, and that by moving the dash 2, I think that he is recommending that section 2 be added from the dash 2 amendment.
That is correct.
So we would, if you wanted both the dash 2 and the dash 1, we would stay with the language in the dash 1 and then add that section from the dash 2. Just wanted to make that clarification before you got too far along.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Question for Senator Beyer. Does anything in the bill that we have adopted as amended prohibit an employer from essentially creating a more safe work environment by requiring a stricter standard tie-off?
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I would like to ask that question of someone from OSHA.
Okay.
I do not know the answer to that question because...
Someone from OSHA here? Come on up, please. You put your name on the record and see if you can address the question for us.
Sure. Members of the committee, my name is Meg Reinhold. I'm Senior Policy Advisor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which is the umbrella organization in which OSHA resides. If I can just restate the question, would an employer be able to impose a stricter standard than the 30 feet standard? Is that without any consequence? Is that correct?
That's correct.
I believe that's true. I think the that's one of the amendments just require us to go to have the ceiling at 30 feet.
Okay.
Chair, Senator Beyer.
Question of Meg. If the four OSHA rules currently say 10 feet for everyone.
Correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
If the legislature
determines that a 30-foot rule or the CINRAC rules is safer than a 10-foot rule, would then employers be potentially subject to a OSHA violation by saying, no, we're going to stay at 10 feet?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the complication arises, I think, in the question. OSHA is a program that's approved by under federal OSHA. So our obligation is to meet the federal, at a minimum, meet the federal standard, and we can be stricter than the federal standard. We have to be as safe or more safe. So there's a bit of a confusion because normally policy direction is given from the legislature. In this case, it's a little bit other. Correct. We get the federal policy direction. So if the rule was adopted pursuant to this bill, 30 feet, certainly someone could petition the federal government and say, we believe that the 10-foot level is safer, and therefore OSHA should find someone. You could go that direction, but it's hard to say. I doubt the federal government would accept that argument. You have to get to the point.
Before you, you said we think the 10-foot level is safer, but
if, Madam Chair, Senator Barr, let me try that one more time. If someone complained to the federal government that the 30-foot standard, if they said the 30-foot standard is safe and requiring fall protection at a lower height is not as safe, so a contractor comes in and says, I want all my people to be wearing fall protection at 10 feet, and then they said that's not as safe as the OSHA requirement, then that person could make an argument to federal OSHA that would say, or OSHA needs to require fall protection at a lower level. And we would have to cite at a lower level. Okay? We don't think the federal OSHA would accept this argument. Or OSHA wouldn't accept it, and we would not cite a contractor who required fall protection below 30 feet unless forced to do so.
Forced by federal OSHA?
Correct.
Okay. Now, that answers your question. I have another question. I don't know if this is the right question to ask it. But specifically to the Dash 2s, in the case of an employer liability suit, if we have a 10-foot height limit now, industry, let's say Intel, Baugh, Hoffman, others around the state, Washington State uses 10-foot, we go to 30-foot, or the CINRAC rules, and someone using that rule, some other smaller contractor says, I'm just going to do what's required under OSHA, so I'm going to go to 30-foot, worker falls, gets hurt, potential lawsuit, and as I said, I don't know if this is a question for you or more of a question for you being a trial attorney, but potential lawsuit comes forward. Could a case be made that the industry standard for safety is 10 feet, so the employer is liable even though he or she was following a federal rule and a state rule, but other than the industry have said 10 feet is safer? So
I don't think so.
Do you understand my question?
And is that a question you feel comfortable answering?
I feel comfortable answering it, Madam Chair.
Tony? Or Senator Corcoran, excuse me.
I would think that if I were defending the company against that liability claim, that I would use the proceedings in this body to make the argument that the 30-foot rule was discussed and implemented at the request of who it was at the request of, and that would weaken the liability case tremendously.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
And if I were the trial lawyer, I would certainly argue the most safe level and whatever. I think the point is you can make an argument either way in terms of bringing a lawsuit, and I don't know that. Well, you're going to get, you could possibly get a lawsuit at either the 10-foot level or the 30-foot level.
I guess it goes to the old
question
thing.
Is who wins and who's held liable.
Who convinces the jury? You put three lawyers in a room, you get four opinions. I guess that's what we're hearing.
I That was Irish Catholics.
That, I guess, would be my argument for the Dash 2 amendments, or the Section 2, however it was put together, is that if employers have offered fall protection and the employee decides not to use it, the employer should not be subject to a lawsuit that he or she has no fault, because they've offered the protection, and therefore we should at least give that to the employer's side of the equation if we're going to do this, to give them some certainty that they're not going to be harmed by our action, because we said 30 feet is better for the employee. Therefore, the employee, if they choose to unhook, they should bear some of the risk if they fall.
Very good closing argument, Senator Bach.
On behalf of the
trial lawyers.
No, on behalf of the defense.
That I guess we vote on the Dash 2.
Any other questions or any other discussion? If not, we have a motion before us. Senator Byer, you did move the Dash 2. And are there any objections?
I am.
I am.
And Senator Corcoran and Senator Brown object. Motion fails. Senator Atkinson, we have an amended bill. Would you like to move it?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3010 as amended to the floor.
Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 3010 as amended to the Senate floor. Do pass recommendation.
Do pass recommendation.
Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
This has got to be one of the toughest bills and issues I've dealt with in my four regular terms and however many special sessions we've had. I honestly came into today's hearing undecided. I don't think it ever happens where I come into a hearing undecided or a work session undecided. Quite frankly, I'm still undecided. I still don't know what is the best public policy. I want the best public policy, which is the safest environment for the workers. And as you all probably have the same file that I have, that I've been trying to find out what I think is safest for the workers. And I believe the policy of 3010, by looking at, I don't know if all of you have seen the 1996 through present or OSHA data for injuries for steel erection workers, or steel connectors, they're called. I have that, and I don't know if you've all been received that or not. But what this data shows is that most of the injuries come from not falls, but from objects running into or workers being squished between two things, which leads me to believe that the most injuries do happen in those instances where the steel connectors cannot get out of the way of an object coming in. So what that makes me believe that this is the best policy, to give them the flexibility to get out of the way. At the same time, the fatalities occur from falls. So whereas you have more injuries from the swinging of steel and cranes moving, the fatalities happen from falls. And it concerns me that we are, deciding between fatalities or injuries, and that's uncomfortable for me as a legislator, and I think all of us for legislators to be in. We want a safe environment for workers. Maybe the answer is better training for crane operators. Maybe that should have been part of the discussion. It hasn't been to date. I'm still undecided. I think I'm going to have to vote against the bill, because had the amendment gone in, I think it would have gone some protection for the companies. I think it would have been the best for both worlds. We had a safer environment for the workers in the case of injuries, the more minor injury. I mean, and no injury is minor, especially when you're 30 feet plus in the air. But I have a hard time to put this liability onto the employers when it's at no fault of their own. They've offered the equipment for the workers, and the workers, for their own safety, choose not to use it. And this is a tough, very tough issue. I guess I think I'm going to have to be no. Sorry.
Senator Byer, I think you've stated it very well, that it's tough for all of us. This is a bill I think every one of us has wrestled with, simply from the fact that we wonder if we are implementing good public policy here for safety of workers and certainly a concern for employers for the simple fact that we don't want to have people sued and be put out of business. So it's certainly a tough issue. Any other discussion, Senator Corbin?
Go ahead. Well, I got to say, I have the same ambivalence. I mean, if someone would have asked me 6 months ago walking into this place, would I raise from 10 to 30 feet the free fall area for a worker, I would have thought the person was crazy. But in this particular case, the passion that the iron workers brought to this, and especially Jeff, and his own personal situation, where not only he but a coworker of his both have boys that are in apprenticeship, and you know, it's like they're making the call. It's like I wouldn't second guess a firefighter making a call on firefighting safety. And these iron workers, I mean, they really live in an incredibly different world than the rest of us. And so, and I know what you're saying about the statistics, you know, and it really does make you wonder about it. But I'm going to support the bill and basically do it because of Jeff, and I think he made his case. That's how I feel about it.
Any other discussion?
I'd just like to add one thing, Madam Chair. I agree 100% with Senator Corcoran about Jeff making his case and the passion the iron workers have brought to this issue. And if they, and I've got it in here somewhere, we all have. And the one thing that really sold me on to vote for the bill, and I still believe that this is good public policy, if you all remember that photo with all the steel spikes sticking up, and that's the thing we need to avoid. And hopefully, if this bill passes, we will get away from the scenario where we have these trip hazards. That's the one that I just was amazed to think that our rules will allow that. And so if nothing else, we've got to make sure we get those trip hazards out of there.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to protect these guys.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
I appreciate both everybody's wrestling with this issue, and for me, the biggest issue is the employer liability issue, and I guess what I'm troubled with the most, frankly, is the fact that I know that the larger companies can enforce a different safety rule on their sites than the smaller companies, and that's what troubles me. I just suspect with the job market the way it is, my guess is employers, both big and small, will have greater latitude at this point in time. That may change, hopefully, as the economy recovers, but I, too, am troubled by the liability issue. And I do think, I mean, I have great faith in our, I mean, anybody can bring a lawsuit. I think the question is whether anybody can win. And I have faith in our court system that these cases can be decided in the appropriate manner, and hope that we don't have very many of them.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Any other comments?
Well,
Senator Atkinson.
Everyone's giving their testimony. This bill for me has been captivating. Not that, like Senator Corcoran, this is the farthest thing from my mind when we started in January. But this is the first time when I can honestly say I've been split, just like all of us have been. And I, for a while, kept a legal pad as people would visit my office and people would, especially during the long public testimony we heard on this 3 hours long, and I would write down good points, pro and con, on each side and really try to weigh this out. The liability for me is a tremendous issue, like we're all coming down on various degrees of it. I really wonder how much liability will change in the environment regardless of the height amount once the height amount is adopted into statute. I'm not a trial lawyer, but I do fear for small companies who have a bit difficulty competing when they bid jobs from and the provider is more powerful perhaps than their ability to set a 10-foot ceiling. So I have wrestled with it, but I have to say that after all the thought and after all this and after investing hours of listening to it on my legal pad, the yeses outweigh the noes. So I will be supporting it.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Any other discussion? If not, Senator Beyer will be recorded as a no. Any other objections?
If not, so moved.
I'm going to reserve the right to change my vote when I get to the floor, because I'm sure we're going to be lobbied between now and when I get there.
You may be lobbied right outside the door, Senator Beyer.
I was unsure on a transportation plan, and I got one time, and I got to play more golf than I ever did in my life.
No kidding. That's a good tip.
Nothing further to come before the committee? I did.
Carrier.
No, I did.
Okay. All right.
Kate, we are adjourned. Thank you, members.
The other thing I